Good evening, everyone. Good to see so many people here. Tonight we have Tom Burney, who's going to be speaking to us on Conversations with God. It's part one. All right, so we've got as a reading Genesis chapter 18.
Thank you, everyone, for reading that. It's fantastic to be here. It's really nice to see you. I'm surprised how many of you that I know, and some of you I haven't seen for a while, so it's nice to see you again. It's good to be here. I'm excited to be talking to you about Conversations with God and sharing some of the things that I've found. And I sort of explored this just because I was interested in it and I wanted to find out more about it. Perhaps you might ask the question, why would we look specifically at Conversations with God? I mean, even just reading this one here, just thinking about it, all these new thoughts are coming to my mind, and I'm thinking, oh, I haven't really thought about it that way before the sermon. I've got more questions. And so here's some of the things that I was thinking when I was looking through these conversations. Questions like, how does God talk? So looking through the whole Bible at the different ways that God talks to people. What attitude do people show when they respond to God talking to them? Why? What is the purpose of the conversations? Are they initiated by God, initiated by people, or is it both, or is it why? That's being looked at, or what are some of the reasons for these conversations? What tone do people use? And this was particularly interesting to me because I was thinking we could learn something about prayer. This is one of the things perhaps I didn't find the same answers to that I thought I would. I've specifically focused on conversations in the Bible where the words of the people and the words of God are recorded. There's lots of times when the Bible spoke to people or the people spoke to God, but we're missing the exact words, and I wanted to see what kinds of tone do people use, because then I thought my own prayers, what kind of tone to use when I speak to God. But as with many of the questions that I have, the answer ends up being necessarily any right way, and people do it all kinds of different ways. It's a genuine and a personal and an open conversation style with God that's different depending on the person that's talking to God. How does God respond to the people they use? And again, the answer is it depends. In fact, there's examples of where people have said the same kinds of words and God's responded to them in a different way, because there's more, there's things that are going on in the heart, not just in the words. What sorts of things do people say to God? What sorts of things who ask God? And we've seen some examples of that in this chapter for sure. What questions does God ask people? And we'll look at this one next session, but there's lots and lots of questions that God asks. It's fascinating, really interesting. What motivations do we see in people's requests? So behind their questions that they ask of God and their things that they say to God, what are the reasons for them asking them? And that comes back and gives us those lessons of what should we be thinking, what should we ask for, what should we care about when we have our conversations with God, when we talk to God, and when we listen to God. I'm actually getting a bit warm, so I'm going to take this off, but I have to adjust my microphone. I might do that in a minute, because I might get you to read around some more. That was fantastic. Here's a question. What is a conversation with God? What does that mean? What does it mean to have a conversation with God? So what I did was I started at Genesis 1 verse 1 and I read through the whole Bible from beginning to end, and I just wrote down every conversation that I could find. And then I went back through them all again and I classified them. And then I went through each of the ones that I'd classified and I made a short list, and then I went through those in more detail, and I was just scratching the surface. It's fascinating. The classifications that I used were: a full, meaningful conversation. These are the ones we're going to be looking at tonight and next time. And there's more of them than we could even get through in a couple of sessions, but we'll look at some of them. These are conversations where we know the words are recorded of both God and the people, and they have a back and forth conversation where God says something, they say something, God says something, or vice versa. So that's what I would consider to be a conversation. There are sort of half conversations where God says something and they say something back and that's the end of it. Or they say something to God and then God says something back and that's the end of it. And I classified them as sort of, that's the next level. And then I came across other, not really conversations anymore. Thank you. which are just one-sided conversations where maybe someone prays to God and God shows a response by the way that he acts. Or God does something and they do something in the way that they act, but there's not really a conversation going on. And then the next level down from that is where it's like a prayer or a command with not necessarily a response recorded. So you've got all the way from detailed conversations with back and forth all the way down to a prayer or a command from God or some written words, which are just a one-way conversation. And so there's that whole grading. And then there's conversations which I couldn't classify, which were missing enough information for me to be able to know where they sit. And there's conversations which we have to guess at who it was that was talking and how it was they were talking and maybe even the words that they said to be able to have that conversation. But we'll look at this as we go. I'm interested in the words and I'm interested in the tone, so I'm going to look at some specifics. Let's look at Genesis chapter 3. So let's all turn to that. The first question that we're asking is, how does God talk to people? In the end, of course, it doesn't matter how God talks to people. If the Bible says God said it, then God said it. It may have been that God said it through an angel. It may have been that he said it through a voice from heaven. It may have been that he said it through a person as a prophet. It doesn't matter how he said it. If it says that he said it, then he said it. And I think that's important to remember that to start with, because there's going to be some cases where we actually don't really know how he communicated. It just says God said it. And you have chapters like this one in Genesis 18 that we just were reading before, where there's lots of different ways that it says that God spoke to them. There was an angel that spoke to them, but then it says that it's Yahweh that spoke to them, but then it says that it was a man that was speaking to them, and it was three men, and so, okay, there's all sorts of interesting things. We're going to look at that in a bit more detail a bit later. But let's look at Genesis 3. Let's start with verse 8. Can we read verses 8 to 10 from wherever we're up to? That'd be great.
And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden.
Then the Lord God called to Adam and said to him, "Where are you?"
And he said, "I heard thy voice in the gardens, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself."
So we can see that they said here that they heard the voice walking, which in itself is an interesting kind of concept. What does that mean to hear the voice walking? And you could look at different translations, but the point is that God is communicating with them by whatever way that he's communicating with them. Sometimes it's not recorded clearly exactly what is meant by the way that God communicates with them. And this is an example of that. And we'll see this again in Genesis 17, which we'll get to later when God talks to Abraham. That there's these ways that he's communicating. And they try to hide from God, and of course they can't hide from God. And so this is an interesting example. And I've sort of presented these as conversations. God asks the question to start the conversation. He says, "Where are you?" And of course, God knows where they are. But what's really interesting, and you see it again, here's a question. And this right-hand column is where God speaks, and you're going to see so many questions. In fact, this entire column is nothing but questions, which I think is fascinating. And the more we do it, we're just going to see it again and again, that God asks questions. Because he wants us to think about it. He wants them to think about it. He wants that reflective kind of an approach. "I heard thy voice in the garden because I was afraid and hid myself." Now, I struggled with exactly how to go through this because I thought if I just do nothing but going through the conversations, then we're just going to be looking at conversations. That actually wouldn't be too bad because even just looking at the conversations and talking about them I think is really interesting. But also because I've looked through the whole Bible, I've found things that are common themes, that this comes up again and again, this comes up again and again, and this happens again and again. Okay. So what I'm just going to try and do is I'll try and focus a little bit on common themes, but also at the same time we're going to work through some conversations. So we're going to talk about themes multiple times, but we'll also, as we go, we'll look at a conversation, then we'll move on to another conversation, and we'll keep on talking about some of the themes that we're going to come across. So sometimes that means we're going to spend a little while in a section, sometimes we'll just move through it pretty quickly. But later on, and as we go, we're going to keep talking about this one that we've already seen. So we can sort of look at this conversation, put it in the back of our mind, And then over the course of the night, I'll keep mentioning this conversation, even when we move on to other conversations, because this contains elements that so do other conversations that we're going to see. So, we're talking about forms of God's communication. One of the ways that he talks is that he's not necessarily clear exactly what it was, but just that he communicated with them and he asked them questions, and they hid from that. If we would look at Genesis 15, which, I mean, we could turn that. Can I just get someone to read Genesis 15, verse 1 and 4? I guess wherever we're up to, you can read Genesis 15, 1 and 4. That'd be fine. Genesis 15, verses 1 and 4. I'm just thinking we could just... read the whole thing, that's fine. Yeah, 1 to 4.
After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. And Abram said, Lord God, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, Behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, This shall not be thy heir, but he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir.
Great. So we've had an opportunity to look at another conversation between God and Abram in this case. This time God doesn't ask any questions. This time it's Abram asking the questions. And it's interesting to notice the way the conversation starts. And we so often see the conversation starting this way that it says, fear not. That's often the way God starts. So there must be this fear on the part of the people that God's talking to. God asks this question. Abram asks this question and he is trying to understand how God's going to fulfill this promise. And it's okay that Abram is asking this question. God doesn't get mad with him and say, how come you're not believing? It shows that he did believe. He wasn't asking necessarily because of disbelief, but because he wanted to understand, and that's totally fine. So one of the ways that God talks to people is, even as we saw in verse 1, in visions or in dreams. In chapter 18 today, we saw that God speaks to people appearing as a man or men, as angels. Another example of that, which we won't turn up, is when Joshua meets a man on the way, and it turns out to be the captain of Yahweh's armies. And he has a conversation with the captain of God's armies, and he says, are you with us or against us? He says, I'm not with your army or their army, I'm God's army. I'm the captain of their army, and they have that kind of a conversation. And one of the ones we're going to look at later, which is one of my absolute favorites, is the story of Samson's parents. When Manoah and his wife have a conversation with an angel, and his wife seems to recognize that it's an angel, but his husband is oblivious and thinks it's just an ordinary man. So that's very interesting. In Exodus 3, God appears to Moses in a fire in a bush. And it says, and we're not going to turn to it, but we will actually do it next week, or 2 weeks' time. The angel of Yahweh appeared in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. God isn't the angel. God isn't the bush. God isn't the fire. But he appears through and out of those things. And so he can do it in all kinds of different ways. And he doesn't always appear the same way, and that's interesting. And so it's not as if someone could say, well, our God always appears this particular way, because he doesn't. He appears in a way that matches the circumstances that are required and the people that need it. And he knows best, and he knows what's going to work and why. And he has deeper meaning to what he does in his manifestations. Sometimes God speaks through a named angel, like Gabriel. Sometimes he speaks through prophets. Sometimes he speaks as a voice from heaven. This voice could be out loud so that all of us could hear it, or it could be a voice that only one person could hear, but is still a voice from heaven. I've got a list. The other conversations that we have here were Genesis 17 and Genesis 18. We're not going to read through Genesis 17, and we already read Genesis 18, but they're just examples of conversations. In the second half of Genesis 15, we've got this chapter where God takes Abram out and says, look at the stars. And again, he asks the same question that he asked previously, which is, how is this going to happen? And God makes a covenant with him. And Abraham divides it into two piles. And he keeps the birds off it.
And in the morning,
when the sun went down and it was dark, a smoking furnace, a burning lamp, passes between these pieces. And we're going to see some similar symbology coming up in a lot of conversations. That one of the reasons why God does these conversations is because he's thinking about the covenant with his people. He's thinking about the deliverance that he's going to work. That he's represented in fire or burning or furnaces or lamps and all these sort of symbols that come up again and again. And this, unto thy seed have I given this land. And we see that link to the ultimate purpose, the seed working Christ in the future. Genesis 17, which we're not going to read, but is another example of a conversation with Abram. God says to him, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be thou perfect, and I will make my covenant between me and thee. And Abraham falls on his face. Now, that's the King James version of it. If you read any other version, it would just say he bowed with his face to the ground. But this is a phrase we see again and again and again in these prayers, that they, in response to God talking to them, they fall flat on their face. And there's this respect. But we see in the unfaithful, when we look at examples of people who have conversations with God but aren't faithful, they don't have that respect for God, that reverence for God. They stand up with pride and with arrogance. And they don't want to listen to God, and they don't have any need to respect him. As for me, God says, behold, my covenant is with thee. As for Sarah, Sarai, thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, and I will bless her and give thee a son. And it says Abraham fell on his face again and laughed. Shall it? He's incredulous. This is amazing. This could happen. Shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old? Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. Sarah, thy wife, shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him. So this focus on this covenant. And he left off talking with him. And God went up from Abraham. Whatever God meant in this case, God manifest in some way, went up from Abraham after that conversation that he was having with him. We saw this conversation today. When we read this, my Lord, if I have found favor in thy sight, there's this respectful nature to the tone that he uses with God. If I have found favor in thy sight, and we see this again and again in the next conversation, he offers to make him a meal. So do as thou hast said. Abraham and Sarah, prepare this meal. Where is Sarah thy wife? Behold, in the tent. Again, it's that question. God knew where Sarah was. I think it's worth, whenever we see God asking a question, to stop and think, how come he's asking that as a question? That's interesting. Why wasn't Sarah out there with him having that conversation? Why did God ask the question of Abraham? What's he getting at? Why is he doing that? And I'm not going to answer or look into all of these different questions that God asks, but I think it's fascinating that he asks them as questions when he already knows the answer. And it comes back to us in the way that we pray in our prayers. He knows what we need before we ask it, but he wants us to ask it. And he will do things differently depending on what we ask. And just because he knows what we need doesn't mean that he's necessarily going to give us things in a particular way. It depends on what we ask. Even if we just think it, there's something powerful about prayer and about God's questions that have this interaction that would be more than if it was just assumed knowledge on the part of one or the other in the conversation. I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son. And Sarah laughed within herself. And she said, after I wax old, shall I have pleasure? It's a very similar question to what Abraham said before. And yet, there's something different going on in the heart here and in the way that God responds to that. So it's not just the words that we say, but something that goes on in the heart as well. Wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I of a surety bear a child which am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? Which is a phrase that, again, we see coming up in many of these conversations, so keep that one in mind too. I laugh not, says Sarah. Nay, but thou didst laugh. And the men rose up from thence and looked towards Sodom, and we have that conversation where back and forth, Abraham respectfully, reverently says, please don't be angry, can I just ask one more time? And it's fascinating that it's back and forth. And each time it happens, Abraham is emboldened to ask again with a smaller number. And it's quite possible that if Abraham had never asked at all, God would still have done exactly what he did and saved Lot's family. I mean, when Abraham asked the question, will you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? The answer might have already been no. It's possible, or it's possible that his prayer made a big difference to the way that God decided to use that situation. We don't know the answer to that, but it's interesting to think about how that might have been and what difference that prayer may have made if Abraham hadn't spoken those things, asked those questions. In general, prayer is not something that is for God's benefit because he knows what's going on. We do it for our benefit. And it's worth thinking about that. When we think about these conversations. When we look at this list that I've sort of made, how does God talk with people? We've listed some of those things. Often unclear. Visions or dreams, described as man or men, out of fire sometimes. Sometimes there's an angel that's named, sometimes it's prophet, sometimes it's a voice out of heaven. Sometimes that voice out of heaven is Jesus speaking from heaven. But remember, he's a mouthpiece of God too, so it's all manifestation of God's words. And sometimes the method's not recorded. An example I have there of 2 Corinthians is Paul says he asked God to take the thorn out of his flesh. And he records the words that God says to him. God says, my grace is sufficient for you. Now, it doesn't say how God said that to him. It just says that he said that to him. We don't know. But it's interesting because that's a conversation with God. And we know, if we think about this last one down the bottom here, that in Hebrews it says, and I'll just read this. God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds. So in these last days he's spoken unto us by his Son. That's him speaking to us. We have to listen. That's an interesting sort of part of the conversation. And even in 1 Samuel 3, we read that the word of the Lord was precious in those days because there was no open vision. So it varies. Depends on the time period, depends on the people he's talking to, depends on why it is that he's talking to them. So there's not necessarily just one way that it does it. It's hugely varied. But he doesn't seem to speak to us now the same way that he has done some of those other times. But that's not just us. There have been plenty of other times when the way that he speaks to us is the way that he spoke to them. It just depends on, well, God knows best. Any questions? You don't have to ask questions. I just thought I'm happy to. It's my teacher in me saying, you're not asking questions.
I'm curious about one thing.
Yeah.
So in many of these examples, it's not God talking.
That's right.
So I have a view that God gives high-level instructions and the angels work out how to do it,
mm-hmm.
and I take that from Daniel.
Yep.
I can't do this.
Yep, totally. Yeah. I totally agree with you. And the same with the prophets. God will give them a message and he'll say to Moses, you're my mouthpiece, you'll speak my words. And the prophets will go and have conversations with kings. There's an example in Samuel where there's this conversation back and forth between God and the leaders of the nation. And leaders of the nation say something to Samuel, and then it says Samuel prayed, and then God spoke to him, and then he went back to the leaders, and he spoke something back to the leaders in this back-and-forth conversation through Samuel. Sorry, I sort of interrupted you, but...
Yeah, but what you're saying is that God's talking,
mm-hmm.
but clearly God isn't talking.
Yep.
Have I missed...
No, this is fine. No, I'm totally with you on this, and I probably could have made that clear at the start, is that I'm not necessarily looking at places where you could say God is directly talking to someone or with someone, but I'm looking at conversations, right, which involve God saying something through any means of communication, whether it's through a prophet, through a vision, through an angel, through, because he speaks through us too. We can be his hands, his arms, his legs, his mouth, in a way, we can be manifestations of God to each other. But in these particular ones, I'm trying to find places where it seems to be indicated that these are messages from God in some form, and then they respond to that. So we saw in Genesis 18 today that it specifically said, and Yahweh said. even though we know that it was an angel that was saying it, it wasn't God himself. But it does say in the text, and Yahweh said. So I'm stretching my definition of conversation with God a little bit, just for the sake of interest of study. And I recognize, for example, some conversations, again, like Jesus might be talking to people from, having spoke to Paul from when Paul had that vision on the road to Damascus. It says Jesus was speaking to him. But we could still look at that as an interesting conversation, because we know that Jesus, he says the words that the Father would speak, I would speak the same thing. And so we've got that idea that the way that God would respond in a situation is the way that his Son would respond in a situation. So it doesn't, ultimately doesn't make an enormous amount of difference. And I hope you can forgive me for making that extra stretch and just exploring some of these in that way, even though I recognize that it's not strictly the direct conversation. I hope that that's, so I recognize that, and I hope that that's all right.
The other side of that point is that when we talk to God, we do talk to God.
That's true, yeah.
So that throws a lot of more observation. That we're not talking to an angel, we're not talking to an intermediary of any sort.
It is different, yeah. And if you think about all these different ways, it's true that they are not necessarily God directly speaking, but they are some way that he communicates a message to people. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, perhaps the word that I've used, conversation, maybe, the way that I'm thinking about these, maybe, but I think it's interesting. And we do see at the end of chapter 18 of Genesis, and it says that he left off talking with Abraham. So there's this aspect at which the Bible considers it to be talking with, to whatever extent. And so I think it's interesting to think about it and reflect on some of the things that we see that they have in common. So thanks for asking that question. I'm glad you did. Feel free to ask questions at any time if you want to, or add things to that, because I mean, there's so much more that I would be interested in finding out about this, and so many questions that I have, so many things that I'm not sure about, or it's because it's huge. I'm trying to look at 6,000 years worth of conversations with God, as such as they are, and I'm not going to do them justice, but I just want to have a look at them with you, and we can just explore that adventure together. Let's look at the emotional response that people have. Adam and Eve hid because they were afraid. So the natural sort of thing that people seem to do when they recognize they're in the presence of God or his angels is they tend to hide or be afraid. With the counter example of that is if we look at Genesis 4, Cain, his offering wasn't accepted, and so he murders his brother, which is a bit of an overreaction. God says, why? Again, God's asking questions. Why are you wroth? Why has the countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? Rhetorical questions. If thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. Where is Abel thy brother? And on your point, it's possible that that could have been hidden from the angel that was there. It's possible that he didn't know. But we don't know that. But the point is he asks that question for a reason, which is to get Cain to be reflecting and thinking about that. Oh, yeah. Now, Cain's response is arrogant. He's not interested in humbling himself or learning anything from this situation. He says, am I a brother's keeper? There's no, like, humility. There's no reverence. There's no falling on his face. There's no fear. Nowhere in this situation is any of that. It's just Cain saying, I'm not interested. It's not my responsibility. Until, why hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth out to me from the ground, and now thou art cursed. This at least slightly humbles him. My punishment is greater than I can bear. And God shows mercy on him in spite of his initial lack of humility. It seems like perhaps it humbles him a bit. And he offers that whosoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken, gives his protection to him. And we'll see how important it is for us that we see the mercy of God, and that whatever situation we find ourselves in, we can humble and God listens. And he's not interested in dealing with people that are proud and people that are not wanting to listen to him. When God spoke to Abraham, he started with fear not in that vision. We know that Abraham fell on his face. So we're thinking about the way people respond when they see an angel, when they recognize they're in God's presence or something that represents God. At the burning bush, Moses hid his face, it says, for he was afraid to look on God, because there was a burning in the bush and angels spoke to him about. He was afraid to look at God, it says. So he covered his face. When an angel made himself visible to Balaam, he bowed down his head and he fell flat on his face, it says. He threw himself to the ground. When Gideon perceived that the man he was talking to was an angel, he said, "Alas, O Lord Yahweh, for because I have seen an angel of Yahweh face to face, alas." And the angel replied, "Peace be unto you. Fear not, you shall not die." When Elijah heard God's voice, he covered his face with his mantle. When Isaiah, well, let's go to Isaiah. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 6. I would love to go into this in more depth, but I've only got a limited amount of time, so I'm actually going to go into this one in more depth on Sunday morning, actually, if you're curious to hear more. In the year of King Uzziah's death, and I hope you don't mind if I read it this time, I saw the Lord seated on a high, elevated throne. The hem of his robe filled the temple. Now, we're told in the New Testament that he saw a vision of Christ. This was Christ on the throne. The hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs stood over him. Each one had six wings. With two wings they covered their faces and two they covered. We're not going to get into all the meaning and symbology. It was fascinating. The sound of their voices shook the door. And we see in verse 5, we see Isaiah's response. He says, "Woe to me. I am destroyed, for my lips are contaminated by sin. My eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of heaven's armies." But then, one of the seraphs, one of the flaming, burning ones, so it's to do with fire again, flew toward me. In his hand was a hot coal he had taken from the altar. Now, it's worth noticing that because we see again and again and again coming up in these conversations, this concept of relationship with sacrifice, with the covenant, with the altar, with the purpose that God has, the long-term plans. He touched my mouth with it and said, "Look, this coal has touched your lips. Your evil is removed. Your sin is forgiven, is purged, the burned away." I heard the voice of the Lord say, "Whom will I send? Who will go on our behalf?" Look at the different response here. Instead of being afraid now, because he knows his sins be forgiven, he's been accepted in the presence of God, he immediately responds to this. God says, "Who will I send? Who will go on our behalf?" And I answered, "Here I am. Send me." Whereas at first he was, "I don't want to be sent, not me, because I'm contaminated with sin." And that purifying, that symbolic forgiveness of his sins made him ready to go on God's behalf, on Christ's behalf. And God said, "Go and tell these people," and he has a message. You won't read the message, but there's a whole message for his people. And if you will read this message, it's about the remnant returning, the destruction, the purpose long-term that God has with his people. So we saw a vision of the Lord sitting on a throne. "Woe is me. A live coal purges his lips. Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" More questions. "Here I am, send me. Go and tell." Now, God could have just said to him, "Go," and skipped, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" But he asks that question. He wants that interaction from us, the involvement of the voluntary involvement rather than just the unthinking obedience. And the willingness to ask our own questions. "Lord, how long?" God says initially there's going to be this massive punishment on the land. They're not going to be able to see. They're going to be blind. They won't understand. And Isaiah says, "How long?" And God gives a response and talks about the deliverance that would be. It should be without inhabitant, but yet in it shall be a tent and it shall return that deliverance. So if we think about some of the things that we've seen, I mean, I could list more, and I've only just listed some of them here. There's just, I'll just keep going and going. But when Hezekiah had a conversation He turned his face towards the wall, again covered his face. Ezekiel received a vision of a man clothed in linen. He fell on his face, threw himself to the ground. When an angel appeared to Zacharias, he was troubled and fear fell upon him. Same with Mary. When Jesus appeared to Paul on the road to Damascus, he fell on his face. There's this immediate and natural response to recognizing that you're in the presence of God or one of his angels, of reverence, deep reverence and recognition of our place in sinfulness compared to God and our need for forgiveness. They hid, they covered their face, they turned their face to the wall. They get told, fear not, by the angel, because they must be afraid to start with. They fall with their face to the ground. They cry, alas, because they've seen God. And we get this fear by the faithful, but maybe not so much by the unfaithful. And we think of Hebrews 12. Let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. I mean, you might be able to think of some other examples of scriptural examples that just show how important it is for us to have that reverence to God when we think about him, when we pray to him, when we read his word. For our God, it says in the next verse, Hebrews 12, 29, for our God is a consuming fire. Something to think about. Another opportunity for comments or questions, if you like.
Was there more fear when people knew they'd done the wrong thing?
Weirdly not. You'd think so. But what's interesting is you see so many unfaithful and arrogant who don't have that fear and they don't care. And that's interesting. Yeah. Because I kind of thought that would be the case. You'd think they'd be the ones, but no, they don't care. And we see the same thing around us today. The people that are the unfaithful, they're not worried about what God thinks. They're not in fear of God. They don't care about him. It's the people that know and care about God that are worried that, you know, they recognize their sinfulness. If you don't care about God, you don't care about sin. It doesn't bother you, which is it's interesting. Next thing I want to think about is the reasons, the whys. Let's have a look at Numbers chapter 22. And I'm thinking, let's turn there. Let's go to Numbers 22. We're okay for time. Let's go to Numbers 22.
Sorry, I just have a question.
Yeah, sure. Sorry.
In the New Testament, are the angels generally glowing and bright and not in the Old Testament, or is that?
I didn't see any clear distinction. There's a variety of both in both kind of thing. Yeah, there definitely were examples in the Old Testament where it was like that as well. I mean, we saw Moses when he saw the burning bush. When you look at Manoah and his wife, Manoah's wife comes back and says, I saw a man and he had the appearance of an angel and she was afraid of him, but she forgot to ask him his name or something. And, yeah, it's all interesting kind of, yeah.
Sorry, Thomas.
But it could be that contributes to the fear. It could be for sure, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Sorry.
No, I was finished talking.
I was just going to say, when I asked my question, I was thinking more about the faithful when they've done something wrong. Like the Adam and Eve's of the day.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Because absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah.
Or even when you would say they haven't done anything, but definitely when they've done something wrong, like Adam and hide themselves. But it doesn't even take for them to have necessarily had something we would consider to be a major mistake. Like Isaiah considered himself to be sinful. He took upon himself the sinfulness of the people around him. He sort of said, I represent all these people. I'm with all these people and we're all sinful. We're all cursed. We all need forgiveness. And so he had to be forgiven. I mean, he knew that he was sinful. It's not like he was a perfect person and none of us are, and you recognize that. I think we'd probably be the same if we knew that someone was from God. We'd be like, I've got some serious problems that I'm not able to stand in the presence of God because I'm too imperfect. Yeah.
Just to add a point to that.
Yep.
In Isaiah 57, verse 15, God says that he dwells in a high and holy place, but in heaven says with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and revive the heart of the contrite ones. So I think we have to be a little careful with what we mean by fear.
Yes.
It's not terror. It's obviously a recognition that we're human.
Yeah, deep reverence, yeah.
But God wants people who are contrite, humble. Even a broken spirit is from the Psalms. So we should not feel any sort of fear, in certainly not in prayer. I mean, when Christ or an angel appears to us, however it's going to be, I think we want to fall down too.
Mm.
But hopefully it's not terror.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's, you know, I'm in the presence of someone who's immortal and, wow, it's finally happened.
I think that's a good distinction to make, because when you think about the difference between people like Adam and Eve, they didn't bow down in reverence. They hid in fear, and that's different. So that's really interesting. Yeah.
So, Tom,
thanks.
Do you think there's a link between the way that people respond in Exodus 33?
Are you thinking about the... which aspect are you thinking about?
Any human being sees my faith, they will die. So you're highlighting a lot of examples where God's messengers are talking, that because of the proximity... that immediately makes them scared for their life.
It could be. It could be, for sure. Yeah. And we think about the nation of Israel at the mountain. They were like, don't speak to us anymore. We're too afraid. Because they were worried about God and his power. Yeah, it's entirely possible that... Because they're saying things like, I've seen God, and God said, have you seen... Yeah. It could be some connection there, for sure. And it's hard to necessarily, I think... disentangle some of the because they use the word fear in the King James for both reverence and afraidness. I haven't really looked at that distinction, but that's interesting. You have to think about that. So the story of Balaam, God comes via an angel to Balaam because the people from Balak have come to see him to try and convince him to prophesy good to basically the nations around Israel and curse Israel. And so when they come to essentially the inn where Balaam is staying, the angel says, who are these men who are with you? Again, starting the question. And Balaam replies, Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent these people to me because they've got a mission. And God says, you will not go with them. You will not curse the people because they are blessed. So you can't curse the people of Israel. And Balaam does the right thing and he doesn't go with them. But they keep on pestering him. They keep on coming and bothering him. They come again and again. They're like, Balaam, we want you to come and we want you to curse the people of Israel. And Balaam says, no. They come again. And he says, okay. So this time, again, he prays to God. He says, look, I can't come with you until I make sure that it's okay with God. So he asks God. And God says this, if the men come to call thee, rise up and go with them, but yet the word which I say unto thee, that shall they do. Now he disobeys that because he goes even though the men don't come and get him. He goes anyway. And God is angry. And there's the whole story where the donkey would not move down the path because there's an angel standing in the way and Balaam can't see the angel. And so he smites the donkey. Wherefore, says the angel, wherefore hast thou smitten thy ass three times? Behold, I went to withstand thee because thy way is perverse before me. And here we get this humility when Balaam realizes what he's done and he recognizes that. He says, I have sinned, for I knew not that thou stoodest in the way against me. And he recognizes what he's done is wrong. And then after this conversation, I was going to read it now. I think for the sake of time, I won't read through it now. But certainly very interesting. And often what we see in these situations is after a conversation, the last thing God says to them is, regardless of all the things that have happened, go. Go is a word that we see again and again, that there's action. And so conversations with God are not, sometimes they are because for learning or for whatever, but often it's because God has something that he wants to be done. And so people become his hands and his feet and actually make things happen, or his voice, and they speak his words. And so he says, go. And there's times, plenty of times, when people don't want to do what God says. We think about Jonah, we think about the reluctance of Moses, we think about Jeremiah has lots of complaints about how bad it is. And they're reluctant to do what God wants them to do. And they have these conversations with God, and God says, enough, go. And actually, in some situations, he actually literally says the word enough. And he says, go and do it. It needs to be done. And in this case, this happened too. And then in chapter 23, chapter 24, Balaam offers seven offerings on seven altars and then repeats that three times. Ultimately, he does those blessings for God's people, and he doesn't say anything bad against God's people. And all he can say, all he can speak of, is the good future, the hope that God's people are going to be able to work because of God. Now, we have to look at Judges 13, because this is absolutely one of my favorites to look at. So let's turn to Judges 13. We'll just look at this one, and then we'll finish up for tonight. But I just really wanted to look at this one. And there's so much that I haven't unpacked in so many of these, and you could do a study about each of them if you looked at them in depth and found I've got lots of questions and things I don't know the answer to, but it's still very, very interesting. I think I've enjoyed looking at them. So we'll read Judges 13, and we'll start at verse 3. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman. So this is the wife. I don't know why her name isn't given. She's always described as the wife of Manoah. I don't know the answer to that. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "You are infertile and childless, but you will conceive, and you'll bear a son." And he tells it about the Nazarite stuff because it's Samson. And the woman runs and tells her husband. The angel specifically gives her all these instructions about exactly how she needs to do this. And then she goes to see her husband, and her husband says, "Oh, well, we better find out what we need to do." And Manoah prays to Yahweh in verse 8, "Please, Lord, allow the man sent from God to visit us again, so that he can teach us how we should raise the child who will be born." God answered Manoah's prayer in verse 9. God's angel visited again the woman, doesn't visit Manoah, visits the woman, it says, no name, the woman, while she was sitting in the field, but her husband, Manoah, was not with her. And it's interesting to me that in verse 6, a man sent from God came to me, he looked like God's angel, he was very awesome, and she recognized that. The woman ran at once the second time and told her husband, "Come quickly, the man who visited me the other day has appeared to me." So it seems like she thinks that he looks like an angel, but it's not certain about whether it is. So Manoah got up and followed his wife. When he met the man, he said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to my wife?" And he said, "Yes." Or in the King James, "I am." Manoah said, "Now, when your announcement comes true, how should the child be raised and what should he do?" And the angel says, "Your wife should do all the things that I already told her." He doesn't have any necessarily new things to say. "Look, I already told Manoah's wife what to do." But Manoah wanted to hear it for himself, I guess. Manoah says to the angel of the Lord, "Please stay here a while so we can prepare a young goat." And that's interesting because that's the same thing that Abraham and Sarah did when those angels came to visit them. And it reminds me of that the verse in Hebrews about entertaining angels unawares. Don't be hesitant to show hospitality, because by doing so, people have entertained angels unawares. He said this because, I better not skip this verse. The angel of Yahweh said to Manoah, "If I stay, I will not eat your food. But if you want to make a burnt sacrifice to Yahweh specifically," and I wonder if in the wording of that, particularly in the King James, I wonder, and I haven't looked at this in depth, but I'm just curious about the way that he worded it, whether or not Manoah was perhaps, given that it's the time of the judges, perhaps Manoah was looking to other gods as well as Yahweh and giving offerings to them, and it's entirely possible. Because in the King James Version it says, if you're going to offer an offering, offer it to Yahweh. Let me get to here. He said this because Manoah did not know that he was an angel of Yahweh. So Manoah definitely didn't recognize. It's interesting, it doesn't say they didn't recognize it was an angel. It says Manoah didn't know that he was an angel of Yahweh. I think that's interesting. Manoah said to the angel of Yahweh, "Tell us your name so we can..." I don't know why he's asking that. I'm not sure why. "So we can honor you." So he doesn't recognize the fact that it's God that should be given the honor. He wants to honor this man who he doesn't even recognize as an angel. The angel says to him, "You cannot ask me my name because you cannot comprehend it." Manoah offers an offering, and then it says Yahweh's messenger did an amazing thing. A flame went up from the altar towards the sky, and the angel of Yahweh went up with it. Again, the fire, the offering. And if we think about the purpose of, and what Samson does in the end is part of a deliverance for Israel. So these themes that sort of come up again and again and again. They fell face down to the ground. Again, same thing. The angel of Yahweh did not appear again to Manoah and his wife. After all this happened, now Manoah realized, this is in verse 21, now Manoah realizes that the visitor had been an angel of Yahweh. And Manoah says to his wife, "We will certainly die because we have seen a supernatural being," in my version. And Manoah's wife is, I think she probably had already come to this realization. And she says to him, "If Yahweh wanted to kill us, he would not have accepted the burnt offering and the grain offering from us." And I think Manoah's wife must have been an amazingly faithful person and had really good insight into the mercy and the forgiveness of God and his accepting of that. And I think that's really interesting compared to Manoah. "He would not have shown us all these things or have spoken to us like this just now." And I think we could certainly think about that aspect of God and his character in our prayers, in our interactions with God. His willingness, his mercy to forgive. And I'll just list some other ones before I've just gone through and written, so I'll just flick through and picked some of the ones which involve similar themes. What do we got here? Cain's offering wasn't accepted. He did something wrong and he wasn't willing to accept responsibility. We saw the offering in the smoking furnace and the burning lamp in Abraham. Moses complained that he was of uncircumcised lips. Circumcision was part of Abram's covenant. But ultimately, God worked with Moses, and so those lips were used to speak God's words. And there's a whole, we're going to look at that next time. When God asks Samuel how long he will mourn for Saul no longer being king, he tells Samuel to take a heifer with him for a sacrifice. When God appears to Solomon to have the conversation in which Solomon requests wisdom, he does it in the exact same place where it says the verse before. I think it was Gibeah was the name of the place. This is the place where Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings. So there's this connection between sacrifice, burnt offerings, and the recognition of that. When God had a conversation with Elijah, he sent him to anoint a new king and minister to the remnant of the 7,000 that remained in the land. Isaiah's mouth was touched with a coal from the altar and his sins were purged. We looked at that. When God commissions Jeremiah, he touches his mouth and says he has to put words in Jeremiah's mouth. And we'll look at that next time as well. One commentator said that there is a general principle that God meets with his people on the basis of sacrifice, which is vastly a generalization, but it's certainly true that we meet with him because of the sacrifice of Christ. And also that God expects sacrifice from us. Hebrews 13 says we offer him the sacrifice of praise, the fruit of our lips, to do good and to share what you have, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. And so I was just skimming through some, why did they have the conversations? What's the purpose of some of those conversations? I'll just put some of them up here. It wasn't just about covering their shame. Like they recognized they were physically naked, but what they really needed covering was their sins. And so the conversation that God had with them leads to prophecies about the seed to come and the deliverance and the work that God was going to accomplish. So just lots of some of the themes that just come up when you look at some of these conversations. I'm going to stop now.